You know, I supposed to turn this on. Oh, it's on. Okay. I very much appreciate the opportunity to take this time and share from the Word of God with you. I also want to thank all the people that have been praying for me. Chris called me on Friday night and asked me, could you fill in on Sunday? And I said, yes. And then the texts start coming in. You know, we're praying for you. You'll do a good job. Be easy on us. You know, whatever. So if God uses this in anybody's life, those of you who have been praying for me deserve the credit. Okay? As I thought about what I would share this morning, I didn't have a lot of time to prepare, so I went back to some old sermons that I had done some years ago, and this one that I'm going to, I've modified it some, I shared it 15 years ago, and there's a reason why I chose this particular sermon. It's not particularly spiritual. When I looked at my recordings of past sermons, they were all on cassette tapes. I got rid of my cassette player a long time ago. This was the only sermon, and it was on a CD, so I'm assuming that's how God was leading me. And I need to ask one more thing of you, to be patient with me, because you'll notice I have the habit of clearing my throat. I don't really want to do that, but I have acid reflux. And I don't always have problems with acid reflux. But if you were in my shoes, and the pastor called you on Friday to preach on Sunday, your acid reflux would kick in. And my wife, Lorelai, always thinking ahead, she gave me these peppermint things that I could take while I'm teaching so I'm not clearing my throat. C.S. Lewis, some of you know who he is, wrote The Tales of Narnia, and there I go. And Edmund is a small boy, and when he first gets to Narnia, he meets Aslan, who's the lion, who is a picture of Jesus Christ. And he asks, is Aslan safe? And the answer comes to him, no, he's kind of wild and unpredictable, but he's good. He's good. And I like that, because, you know, we want to fit God into a box so I know how he's going to come through when I need him. But if you've lived enough life, you find that God always doesn't come through for you the way you want him to. He's got bigger and better plans for us. Wouldn't you agree? There's a, as I was thinking about this, there's people who claim to be atheists. And what they say is, I don't believe there's a God. There's people who claim to be agnostic, and an agnostic says, I don't know anything about God, and I don't think we can find out anything about God. There's a deist, and he says, well, I believe there's a God, and he got the ball rolling, but he's on vacation. He doesn't care about what's happening back here. But the great thing is that you and me, as believers in the God of the Bible, believers in God incarnate, Jesus Christ, we have a God who is intimately involved in the outworking of things that happen on this planet and in our lives. We know that, but sometimes we forget it, because life can kind of beat up on us sometimes. So what I'd like to do this morning is look at Psalm 25. If you have your Bible or your iPhone, if you would turn there, and we'll look through this together. When I timed this, I was a little long. So I have my clock here to help me. But I know you'll be patient. And if I go a little long, I don't think you'll get up and walk out. You may give me some looks like, come on, get it going, will you? But I know you're all gracious people. I gave this psalm a name for myself, and I call it a psalm for living. When you read through this, you're going to think, well, who wants a life like that? Because when David ends this psalm, things are not looking very good for him, the way he reveals what's going on inside of him. But the good thing is, there's some things in this psalm that will give us a framework for thinking about life so we can deal with life as it comes along with us. And you understand, when I talk about these things, I'm not going to mention the gospel of Jesus Christ very much, that he died for us, and that is through him we can have a relationship with God. But I want you to understand that's the foundational truth for us. You can't draw near to God unless you've been declared righteous, unless you've been justified, unless you've been given his Spirit. That is faith in Jesus Christ that gives us access into his presence. So when I talk about these things this morning, remember, that's a prerequisite. Now for David, the psalmist, this is before the gospel, before Jesus Christ died on the cross. But his faith was still in God, in the faithfulness of God. So let's look at this together. I've broken this down into a general outline, and I'll just share it with you. I don't have notes to pass out. But in verses 1 to 7, I think the main thought there is we each need to decide who's going to be the master in my life and who's not. In verses 8 through 15, I think the psalmist is telling us we need to consider who our God is and what's important to him. Those are the first two. If we're going to live a godly life and know God and please him, we need to decide who's going to be the boss. And then we need to get to know him. Not just know about him, but we need to have a relationship with him so that we know the way he thinks and the way he thinks about me and how he wants me to respond. And then the third thing is, you might not like this, but you need to accept the fact that life doesn't always turn out like you expected. You know, the great thing about getting older is you can look back. And hopefully, you have a repertoire of events in your life where when you look back, you saw that God was faithful. When you're young, you're looking forward and you're hoping that you'll have experience which where God proves himself faithful and dependable. And this psalm, David wrote it, and you may be familiar with the life of David. Is that the second time I cleared my throat? David is a man who's associated with the hardships of life. When he's very young, he's anointed by king, by Nathan, Samuel the prophet, to be king. There's one major problem. The king is still alive. And when the king finds out that David's becoming very popular, he doesn't like it. And David has to go on the run for many years. Eventually, David becomes king, and he's very successful in establishing the nation. Very successful in defending the nation from its enemies. But then he makes some terrible choices. He gets involved in adultery. He gets involved with murder, lying. And when he's confronted by the prophet Nathan, Nathan tells him, you know, David, God is going to forgive you because you repented, but your life will never be the same. And do you realize he lost three sons? One was killed by a sibling. One was killed by the commander of his army. And the third one was killed by a sibling. He had a daughter that was raped by a sibling. His life was never the same. But you know, if you're a parent, those are tremendous burdens that you have to live with. Especially if you know that you're the reason these things are happening. So I say, David is a guy, he knows life is tough. There was a book years ago written, I can't remember the name of it, but I always remember the very first sentence, life is tough. And people who recognize that do better. But we as Christians, and that's why I say at the end, we need to recognize that, you know, accept the fact that life doesn't turn out the way we think it ought to. Life is tough. So let's look at this psalm together. Let me read for us verses 1 through 7. To you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. My God, in you I trust. Let me not be put to shame. Let not my enemies exult over me. Indeed, none who wait for you shall be put to shame. They shall be ashamed who are wantonly treacherous. Make me to know your ways, O Lord. Teach me your paths. Lead me in your truth and teach me. For you are the God of my salvation. For you I wait all day long. Remember your mercy, O Lord, and your steadfast love, for they have been of old. Remember not the sins of my youth or my transgressions. According to your steadfast love, remember me for the sake of your goodness, O Lord. And this is that section of this psalm that where I think you and David's saying he's done this, but it's to us. We need to decide who's going to be master in my life and who's not. Let's look what David says in verse 1 and in the first part of verse 2. To you, O Lord, I lift up my soul. My God, in you I trust. You know, when David says, to you, O Lord, I lift up my soul, there's a little bit of a picture behind this. In the Old Testament, when the Israelites made animal sacrifices, there was about five different sacrifices that they could make. One of them was a free will or a peace offering. And what was unique about that offering was the person that was making it would take the parts of the animal, I think it was the breast and the shoulder, the right shoulder of the animal, and he would take it to the priest. The priest would prepare it, and then the person making the offering, he could take that offering And he was the one that raised it to God. And they would wave it back and forth. The priest was behind him, holding on also. But he had the privilege of making this offering to God. He's lifting it up. And the offering wasn't simply that he was offering this chunk of meat. It was a picture of him offering all that he had to God. That piece of meat was just representative of all that God had given him. David says, "To you, O Lord, I lift up what? My soul." You know, the great thing about all of us who are sitting in here is that there's a part of us, there's a part of you that makes you, you. You're different. We're all different from each other. We don't think the same way. We don't feel the same way about things. We don't hurt in the same way. We don't love in the same way. We don't fail to love in the same way. And the list can go on. But the point is, you are unique. David was unique. And what was he lifting up to God? That part of him that made him, him. He's kind of a Romans 12:1 kind of guy. And some of you may be thinking, well, what does Romans 12:1 say? But Paul writes, he says, "I appeal to you, therefore, brethren, by the mercies of God, to present yourselves as a living sacrifice every day." Is every day in there? No, but it ought to be in there. Because that's what God desires of us, that I learn how to become this living, breathing, walking sacrifice to him, where I'm living for him, not myself. But that's what David's doing. He's lifting up his soul to God and saying, and we would put it in New Testament terms, "God, I'm a living sacrifice. I want to be that living sacrifice for you." But you know, it's hard to do that if you don't trust the one you're making an offering to. And that's where David says, "To you, in my God, in you I trust." See, trust and offering yourself kind of go hand in hand. It's hard to give yourself to somebody that you don't trust. But what David says, "Lord, I'm choosing to trust you, and I'm going to offer myself to you. Who's going to be the boss? Lord, I want you to be the boss of my life." But you know, I want you to notice something in verse 2, the second part of verse 2. "Let me not be put to shame. Let not my enemies exalt over me. Indeed, none who wait for you shall be put to shame. They shall be ashamed who are wantonly treacherous." If we're going to trust God, if we're going to be the living sacrifice, we're going to have opposition. It may come from your own self. It may come from neighbors, friends. I mean, whatever it is. There's going to be problems out there. And what David is saying, "Lord, when I face those problems, don't let me be ashamed." When I pray about that, my prayer comes out something like this: "Lord, don't let me do something stupid." That could be any number of things. You know, gossiping about people. And in a small town, you don't want to gossip because it doesn't stop with the person you're talking to. It made me, Lord, don't let me play with sin. Don't let me think I can look at a little pornography here. I can look at a movie over here. I can get drunk sometimes. Don't let me play with sin, because sin wants to master me. Because I don't want to shame you or myself before this unbelieving world. But then he says he has confidence. Even though he knows his shortcoming, he has confidence in verse 3. None who wait for you shall be put to shame. Lord, if I'm waiting on you and I'm walking with you, you will. I may do stupid things, but you'll cover for me in a way. And then in the process of deciding who's going to be boss in your life, David asked God for two things in verses 4 through 7. The first thing he asked for, let's read them together. Make me know your ways, O Lord. Teach me your paths. Lead me in your truth and teach me. For you are the God of my salvation. For you I wait all day long. Remember your mercy, O Lord, and your steadfast love. They have been of old. Remember not the sins of my youth and my transgressions. According to your steadfast love, remember me for the sake of your goodness, O Lord. The first thing David's asking for is, Lord, I need instruction. I need to know about you. I need to know what's important to you. That's why he says, make me to know your ways. How do you think about things, God? I need to know that. Teach me your paths. Lead me in your truth and teach me, because you're the one who has saved me and you're the one I'm looking to. So he knows he needs instruction. You know, the great thing for you and I is we've been so blessed, and we kind of take it for granted. When I say we, I'm talking about me too. We have this, the scriptures. And we can have multiple copies in our house. We can look at it anytime we want. Other people in other countries today, it's against the law to have a copy of this. But how are we going to know the heart and mind of God? You've got to know this. You've got to learn what's in this book. And that's why, you know, Christians were always being admonished to get into the Word. And you have to figure out how you're going to do that. You got to have a plan. If you just have good intentions, I know that I've had a lot of good intentions in life, and most of the time I never carry them out because I don't have a plan to do it. I'll give you a simple plan. And you may think, oh, I can't do that. But you can. When I first got married to my first wife, somebody had told me before that I needed to develop a habit of reading the Bible once a year. So, as a good husband and leader in the home, I told my wife, Tony, you need to develop a habit of reading the Bible once a year. She died when she was 56. We got married when she was 22. That woman faithfully read the Bible every year. And some of you may remember this. There was a little book that came out called The Daily Walk. Some of you remember that? You know, they would give you a portion of scripture to read and then some highlights and everything. Well, that's what she used. I called it the daily run because there was so much material you had to get through. I never used it. But I always share this because it can be done. Any one of us here can read the scriptures the Bible once in a year. You know what it takes? Reading about 4 chapters a day. Give or take a little bit. I don't remember exactly, but it can be done. But if we're like David and we're saying, God, I need to know you, the way to do that is get in this book. But then he goes on in verses 6 and 7, and he asks for the second thing. And he says, remember your mercy, O Lord, and your steadfast love, for they have been of old. Remember not the sins of my youth or my transgressions. According to your steadfast love, remember me for the sake of your goodness, O Lord. You know, I like what he's saying here. God, when you think of me, I want you to remember that you're a God of great mercy and a God of steadfast, unchanging love. I don't want you to think about the sins I committed in the past. I don't want you to think about or bring up the things that I've done recently. When you think of me, look at me through your mercy and your love. Have you ever been in an argument with somebody and they say, well, I remember when you did da 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 da, you know? And that's usually a good way to win an argument. Well, yeah, I did. God's not that way. You know, I don't know how he does it, but he says he forgets. He puts them on a shelf and he never goes back to him. And that's what David's asking for. Don't remember my past sins. Don't remember, don't think about my transgressions. What he's asking for there is, Lord, I need the assurance that you and I are in this together, that you're with me, that my shortcomings are not creating a problem between you and me. And that's the wonder of the gospel of Jesus Christ, is that Jesus Christ's death on the cross was so sufficient because of his perfect life, never once violating a command of God, he could become a substitute for me. And so when we put our faith in Jesus Christ, that list of sins has been wiped clean. And I need to believe that and carry that with me in life. Because we all know there's an evil one out there who's always ready to whisper in your ear, do you really think God forgot? Do you really think he forgive you? Yeah, I know, he'll forgive over people, but what about you? We need to be convinced that the slate is wiped clean. And then David, in verses 8 through 15, says we need to consider who God is and what's important to him. Now, for the sake of time, we're just going to go through these relatively quick. But he begins by saying, good and upright is the Lord. Good. Now, we know God is morally perfect. When he says when God is good, what it means is that what he does is always good. And that means when he thinks of you or me or anybody and he's going to work on your behalf, he's always interested in what is best for you. Not what's most comfortable for you, but what's best for you. And then when he says that he's upright, the idea is that God is dependable and he's trustworthy. And because of these things, you and I can reap certain benefits. And God has something for everybody. Let's look at verse 8. Good and upright is the Lord, therefore he instructs sinners in the way. Sinners. He's got something for sinners. He's going to show them the way they ought to go. He leads the humble in what is right and teaches the humble his way. For the humble man, God has something for him too. He's going to show him the way he ought to live and the way he ought to go. All the paths of the Lord are steadfast love and faithfulness for those who keep his commandments and testimonies. Unless we're dead, and I'm assuming most of us are not here, we have life ahead of us, right? And God says, all the paths of the Lord are steadfast love and faithfulness. When you look ahead at your path, what's down there? We don't know, right? You know, for some young people, it might be marriage, having children, you know, a new job, getting a house, all good stuff down there. As you get older, you know, you might be, what's down that road is sickness, financial problems, relationship problems. You know, there's some bumpy roads ahead of us. But what the psalmist says is that all the paths of the Lord are steadfast love and faithfulness. If we're walking on that, if we're walking with God, even bad things that happen to us, God can use them for good, for our benefit. Why? Because he's a God of unfailing love and faithfulness. Hudson Taylor was a missionary to China back in the 1800s, and there was a book that somebody wrote that said, Hudson Taylor's Spiritual Secret. Well, I read that book because I mean, I'd like to know this. It was so simple. His spiritual secret was to have faith in the faithfulness of God. I thought, that's great. That is so simple. Why didn't I ever think of that? Our faith is in God's trustworthiness, his faithfulness. Not my faith. It's not dependent on how much I trust God. It's faith in God's faithfulness. And then in the last section, the psalmist writes that we need to accept the fact that life doesn't always turn out like you expect. And if this is toward the end of David's life, he kind of bears his soul to us. And it's not something to look forward to. He writes, my eyes are ever toward the Lord, for he will pluck my feet out of the net. When David thinks of himself, he feels like he's trapped. Turn to me and be gracious to me, for I am lonely and afflicted. David has this sense of aloneness in life. The troubles of my heart are enlarged. In other words, these troubles don't seem to be going away. They seem to be growing. And then he says, consider my affliction and my trouble and forgive all my sins. And then he says in verse 20, O guard my soul, deliver me, let me not be put to shame. In the beginning, he didn't want to be put to shame. He doesn't want to be put to shame in the midst of hardship. Because I take refuge in you. Most everyone can look back and see some very wonderful times in life. But as I'm getting older, and as I get to know older people, I find out when they look back, they see those wonderful things too, but they do see the hardships, the things that were heartbreaking to him. Maybe you had a marriage that didn't work out right. you know, maybe you're married now and you've lost the love and affection of the early years. Something you thought way back then, that we'll love each other forever. And you wake up, you know, she's okay. He's okay. You know, we get along. But there's no flame like there used to be and you hoped that there would be. Maybe you have health issues. Your health has failed, and health issues are your constant companion. We have some friends they've really looked forward to having grandkids. They've had three kids of their own, but they never got married. Don't intend on getting married. They're never going to have grandkids. That's something they really wanted. But life doesn't turn out the way we think it ought to turn out. And we could list any number of things here. And I think that's what David's feeling. You know, all the things I hope for, Lord, they just didn't quite happen the way I thought they ought to.